date of publication, which is 1995, already 15 years ago. But if you've read that book, you know that this is a book that can provide a framework for understanding Chinese economic development and political reform, political economic reform, up until the present. It seems to be one of the fundamental works in the field in that way. Growing out of the plan, Chinese economic reform, 1978 to 1993. When he was last here, a few years ago, in a memorable session, at least it was for me, with the sweet Juan, excuse my non-existent Chinese, Barry told us that he was about to come out with a textbook on the Chinese economy. Textbooks have that, feeling of dryness and something you only look at to find out a few things if you're not having to take the course. But although this came out of Barry's courses, the Chinese economy transitions and growth is really a phenomenal exercise in the interpretation, a comprehensive account of almost all aspects of Chinese development. So we're really lucky to have Barry here today and look forward to his talk. Thanks a lot, Barry.
Thank you. Well, thanks for that gracious introduction. I'm also a little daunted following Rick. He's spoke about so many things, and I'm grateful because those are lots of things I don't have to talk about now. But also, let me try and weave a few ideas into some of the things that Rick was talking about, because I think our basic view is really quite similar. So we're not going to get into any pyrotechnics here about who sees things in what ways. I very much agree with almost everything Rick said. In fact, I want to start out with some numbers that, or not even numbers, but just pictures. Not because they prove anything. They're kind of a numeric coda to some of Rick's points. But I just want to put some of the pictures up on the screen, kind of in the sense that you'd look at the thermostat and go, oh, that's why I'm feeling warm, is because it actually is hot in here. And I just want to look at GDPs, the simplest possible measure, GDPs, not measured at purchasing power parities or anything fancy, just the GDPs as a share of world GDP at current exchange rates. So I think a lot of, and this goes back a little bit in history, so these are some long-term graphs from 1960 to 2008. And first, of course, I want to show this one because I think it lies behind a lot of our views about America's role in the world, right? Which is the U.S. accounted for almost 40% of world GDP for two decades after World War II, right? And then in the 1970s, there was this dramatic decline in the weight of U.S. GDP as a share of the whole. So as of 1980. It was very natural to think of the world as moving toward multipolarity, U.S. Dominance was decreasing and everything. But, maybe this, what do I do? Oh, here. Ah, that's true. Okay. Whoops. Wait, I wanted to, what's happening? There, that's what I wanted to say. The short story is, it didn't happen, right? I mean, the U.S. share of global GDP declined from almost 40% to about 25%, but then it stabilized, right? And in the 80s and 90s, as a new wave of technological progress emerged out of the United States, as Japan faltered, as Germany faltered as well, as the enormous costs of reunification were borne by the German economy, it slowed down dramatically. So we saw this very different and very surprising pattern where the U.S. didn't shrink as a share of global GDP between 1980 and the present. So, of course, people interpret that different ways. Some people use this to decide, therefore the U.S. is never going to shrink as a share of global GDP, because we have a certain dynamism that many people like to celebrate. But on the other hand, we could just as easily say, look, what we are about to see is, in some sense, the long-deferred erosion of the U.S.'s share in global GDP. And in fact, we do have this sort of interesting but not significant result that in 2008, for the first time, the U.S. share of global GDP did nudge below what it was in 1980. So, you know, whatever long-term trajectory we're talking about, we certainly should expect it to be interrupted and reversed by lots of major short-term movements. Now, when we take those same numbers and just expand them to a couple of other entities, you see a lot of things, right? I mean, when we think about China and the U.S. in the world, you know, the long-term perspective is that the world GDP is still divided overwhelmingly into a huge chunk that's the U.S., a huge chunk that's Europe, and a almost as large but more growing chunk that is East Asia. In this context, China's still pretty small. Right? I mean, China's share of world GDP is about 7%. It's not. So on this point, I definitely agree with Rick that China is a long way from exercising the kind of, if we want, comprehensive national strength that's going to make it a one-on-one competitor to the United States.
Is India in East Asia?
No, India is not in East Asia. Now, I think I would bring a slightly stronger conclusion to what Rick said. Namely, but it's very much consistent with what it is, so I think he's going to agree with me, but let's see. I think what we're really observing is the rise of China as a strong second. In other words, China will be, in relation to the United States, more powerful than any other single country has been within our memory. That much is clear. There was a period in the early 1990s where Japan's nominal GDP actually was about almost 70% of the U.S. Very surprising when you consider the differentials in population and everything. It apparently had a higher GDP per capita. But people who know Japan always felt that that was not reflected in many aspects of well-being in the countries, and certainly in, as you will, comprehensive national strength. So really, I mean, realistically, it would make sense to say that no country in our memory has had 50% of the GDP of the United States, 50% of the aggregate economic power. And China doesn't either, but it will soon. So we're looking at a world where, for the foreseeable future for most of us, people my age, we're really looking at a situation where the U.S.'s dominant role in the world will continue if the U.S. can resolve its problems, if the U.S. can adopt, you know, a series of economic and social reforms that are necessary but are not based on what happens in China. But it's a very different global situation, because China is going to be, really, in a sense, already is, the unambiguous number two power. It's not really the unambiguous number two power in really in any of the dimensions that Rick was talking about, but when you consider that people are forward-looking, and you consider China's growth process, you consider the investments they're making and the trajectories, then we have to say, look, China is already the number two power. And so we're asking questions, really, I think, not so much as to whether the U.S. and China are going to change places, but rather, are we looking at a stable configuration with China as a strong second, with China as a strong number two in the world? So when we look at this picture, we see, first of all, just the numbers. China's economy is much smaller. Even after a growth process, it's going to be much smaller. And it will, of course, eventually surpass the United States in aggregate size. So I tell my kids, you're going to live in a world in which China is larger and probably more powerful than the United States, but I probably won't. And I think that's what is the simplest conclusion that comes from the aggregate numbers. Now, what can we say? I just want to make a few observations about a world in which U.S. is number one and China is number two. Probably not as pessimistic as Rick about frictions that have appeared in the last few months. It's certainly true that there's been a slightly nasty cast to relations in the last few months, but I guess I would look at this more as a natural process of testing that goes on at the beginning of every U.S. administration. The Obama administration came into power making a much more concerted effort to reassure China and establish multi-stranded normalization of relations between the U.S. and China. I think that was an extremely intelligent and forward-looking policy, but it has a big problem, which is it can be misinterpreted as weakness. It's the kind of the Jimmy Carter effect, where a president comes in and says, we're not going to be as unilateral and as bossy. We're going to try and in this case, one of the key words was acknowledge your core national interests. So, of course, the Chinese, being excellent hard bargainers, immediately responded to that opening by saying, great, well, if you're going to respect our core national interests, our most important core national interest is Taiwan, so please get out and don't sell them any military equipment. Well, so it's inevitable that there would be a certain amount of disillusionment about what the U.S. is prepared to do, what the Obama administration is prepared to do. And I think we're going through a necessary kind of recalibration on both sides rather than a secular increase in friction due to the rise of China. In fact, I think there are some reasons to think that China may be able to settle into a stable, strong second role in the world. One of the things you notice, I think one of the most important things, and this also picks up a strand of Rick's discussion, is much of what China's role will be depends on the relationship between China and the rest of East Asia. If we look at China in a global context, one of the immediate things we see in terms of its ability to exercise overall global power is China really has no friends. When we talk about China's close relation with regimes that the United States doesn't like, you notice that all of these regimes are very ambiguous in terms of what they give to China. North Korea, Myanmar, Iran, Cuba, Venezuela, Sudan. I mean, this is a list of countries that China has friendly relations with in some way. Each of them is as much of a burden, or as much of a potential burden, as they are ally. It reminds you, in a way, of Soviet foreign policy in the late 70s and early 80s, when the Soviet Union was dragged down by its support. Of course, very different in many ways, but still, the Soviet Union had many allies in the Third World, but almost all of them were significant drains on Soviet foreign policy. China's been very aware of that. It certainly avoided that trap. But still, you look at that list of countries, I mean, and what countries would we suggest as allies of China beyond this kind of motley list of associates? One of the key questions is, what will be the ultimate relationship between Japan and China and between the other countries of East Asia and China? We've seen for the last 15 years a great deal of friction between China and Japan, friction that the Chinese government has clearly bear some responsibility for inciting and sustaining. I mean, there's a popular feeling in China that is that resents Japan for both historical and contemporary reasons, but that popular feeling was clearly fueled by the way that the Chinese official media dealt with Japan and dealt with objections to Japan. Now, we see what might be an important change in relations between China and Japan. The new government in Japan, in particular through the role of Ichiro Ozawa, the power behind the scenes in the Hatoyama government, this is a somebody who in Japan very much is the heir to the Tanaka faction. And the Tanaka faction had very strong relations in the late 70s and early 1980s with China, with Deng Xiaoping in particular. The relationship between Tanaka and Deng Xiaoping was quite close. And of course, we already see the foundation for a very significant rapprochement between Japan and China. Ozawa took 130 Diet members to Beijing in December, you know, and they met with all of the top Chinese leaders in the Great Hall of the People. So there's a possibility here, and of course we don't know what the outcome is going to be because the foreign policy of the current Japanese government is, I think, very much in flux and not clear if it's coherent or not. But we see this very strange situation now, right, because all of the key East Asian powers, Japan, Taiwan, and Korea, are considering much closer relations with China than they've had in the past decade or so. So come back to this graph for a minute. If we think of China alone, which is what it's been, well, that's not really a prescription for global power. But if we think of China as a cooperative center of an East Asian bloc, or at least an East Asian community of nations that are able to cooperate well, to play nicely together, as it were, to convert their very, very strong economic ties into cooperative political relations, which they haven't been able to do so far, but which they might be able to do as China's economic weight in the East Asian community grows, then we have a very different kind of prescription. So again, I'm seconding something that Rick said, namely that China's role in East Asia will be in some sense more important over the next 20 years, maybe this goes a little bit beyond what you're saying, but might be more important over the next 20 years than just the bilateral relationship between U.S. and China, which of course will be have lots of cases of friction and things like that. And if we look at how China's done so far, it's really been pretty good in terms of the way it's handled its relations with its East Asian neighbors. China-ASEAN relationship, which you know potentially is fraught because of the economic competition between China and ASEAN, China's been very effective in defusing the economic competition by signing a China-ASEAN free trade agreement, opening up to a lot of agricultural products from the ASEAN countries, and more tightly integrating global production networks that cross cross borders across China and and all of East Asia, which I'm going to talk about in just a minute. There's one other factor that that really affects China's ability to be a number two, and that is the enormous degree of concentrated power in China. When we look at China's emergence over the past 30 years, again, let me pick up on something Rick said. He took us back to Deng Xiaoping and the important things that Deng Xiaoping had done. And he understated just a little bit. Obviously, he completely knows this, but the one thing he didn't stress in this context was how strongly Deng Xiaoping invested in renovating the practice of authoritarian power by the Communist Party. Of course, Deng Xiaoping discarded all the old ideologies. But one of the purposes of discarding the old ideologies was to rebuild a modern, rationalized, authoritarian and hierarchical political system. I like to call it the counter-reformation, in the sense that, you know, if you think of the Jesuits in Europe after the Protestant Reformation, rebuilding the Catholic Church, making it more adequate to the modern times, increasing education, creating a network of colleges, and, you know, creating a hierarchical institution that could respond to the challenges of the time. Deng Xiaoping set that process in motion for China as well. And when we look at the Chinese authoritarian political system today, we see a system that is not just unreformed. Actually, it isn't unreformed. It's counter-reformed in the sense that it has much more effectively organized. It has much stronger incentives. It has a much better ideology of what it does. The people in the system are much better trained. They're much better rewarded for being trained. They have an extremely successful system of party schools where people work for years and then spend the time in party schools sharing experiences, getting higher level of training before they move on to the next stage of their career. In other words, China has a organizational system that resembles a professional multinational corporation like General Electric, where career paths are highly specified, rewards are very coherent with the career paths, where the organization makes sense, and therefore where they've gotten away from many of the built-in problems that weaken the communist authoritarian system, even though it's still called a communist party system. Now, that structure has been incredibly successful in supporting the process of economic growth that's occurred in China over the last 30 years. But you can't help notice that one of the things that that structure has managed to do, and it's been especially clear over the last 3 or 4 years, has been that it has defeated all attempts to make this authoritarian structure somewhat accountable. In other words, if we look at the individual areas, if we look at, say, the role of courts in China, it's clear that courts have not begun to play a role in terms of protecting rights of citizens against the government. Courts play lots of important roles, but hopes that those would evolve into some kind of rights protection function, clearly not happening. NGOs, similar. Elections, village elections, similar. Important step, but once the innovation seems to provide any aspect of accountability for people within the authoritarian hierarchy, it's scaled back or defeated. And even what happened in Copenhagen can be interpreted as the refusal of the Chinese authoritarian political system to accept accountability in their policies toward global warming. In other words, there was nothing wrong with their commitments to global warming. They were actually quite impressive. The problem was they weren't willing to sign on to any kind of international regime that would hold them accountable for it. So that means that as we look at China in a number two power role, we have to take into account the fact that China is not just that it's authoritarian, it's that it exercises concentrated power in a way that is extremely impressive and a little bit scary. And that might make it harder for China to have more friends. It gives it surprising capabilities that the U.S. sometimes doesn't have. But it also makes its role, its position in the world a little bit more, hard to square with a sharing of power with others who are at an equal or higher level. So those are kind of imponderables, and it seems to me that one of the crucial questions is, what does the future look like in terms of China's economic trajectory? We know, looking backward, China has grown about 10% per year for the last 30 years. Of course, if you project that forward, then China is very dominant. But we also know that there are two major changes that are going to disrupt in unpredictable ways the growth path that China has been on so far. There are two types of structural change that are being played out in China and will play out differently as we look to the future. The first is the transformation of China from a rural to an urban society, and the second is the transformation of China from a young to an old society. When we look back, we see Chinese hypergrowth. Yes, it's true. China has grown faster, longer than any other economy in the world ever. But part of the reason that that's been true is because the process of structural change, in which a predominantly young workforce is moving rapidly from rural jobs to urban jobs, has been in full flower in China over the past 30 years. We might also say that this authoritarian political system, this modernized hierarchy, has been optimized for precisely this process. You know, if we say, what does this hierarchy do? It feeds the growth process. You know, a successful politician is one who generates investment, who builds new factories, who facilitates this process of structural change, creates GDP growth, he moves up, he gets rewarded. Everything fits together into this incredibly powerful package. But times are changing. Before the global financial crisis, we started to see signs that the great migration from rural to urban in China might be starting to reach some limits, in the sense that rural areas that were highly accessible to the migration process increasingly had already allowed most of their young people. I didn't mean to touch that, so nothing's happening up there. Don't pay any attention. Yeah, okay. So we started to see that the pool of surplus labor in the countryside was being drawn down. And then the crisis hit. And so we couldn't see whether what we had started to observe was in fact a long-run trend. Now, as China has recovered rapidly from the crisis, all of a sudden we're starting to see once again signs of labor, the word that's often used is labor shortage, that's probably not the right term, but signs that this vast export engine that China has is starting to, as it kicks back into operation as the global economy recovers, that it's starting to run into the need to raise wages and increase and improve working conditions in order to continue to attract the workers that it needs from the countryside. So recent articles in both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal that reflect a sort of flood of recent commentary in the Chinese press, that says, once again there are suddenly labor shortages in Guangdong and to a lesser extent in Zhejiang province as well. So it looks like China is reaching a turning point where it no longer has an infinite supply of cheap labor in the countryside. In other words, it looks like China is going to start pushing up wages and reaching a new phase of its economic development. At exactly the same time, China's population is going to start aging. If you look at Chinese dependency rates, so in other words, if we look at the share of the total population that's working, that share is right now unusually high because one-child policy means there aren't very many young dependents. In fact, it reaches its peak right now with something like 72% of the population working. Then, from right now onward, it starts to decline because the population goes through a very rapid aging process for the same reasons that the young population is small now. The aging process will be rapid and intense. So as we look forward, you know, one thing we can say about Chinese economic growth is it will probably slow down. How much? We don't know. It would be foolish to declare. But we do notice one thing. When we look at, say, Japan, Taiwan, Korea, these other very rapidly growing economies, when they reach this turning point, their growth slowed down a surprisingly large amount. Now, I'm not talking about Japan in the 1990s. I'm talking about Japan in 1973. From 1950 to 1973, Japan's economy grew 10.5% a year. After 1973, boom, the growth rate dropped to less than 5%. It never again grew as rapidly as it had always grown before that turning point. Why? We don't necessarily understand. We don't have a very good model for this. But it seems to be much harder to sustain that growth once you reach a certain turning point. Now, China has tried to prepare for that turning point. And one way to interpret China's economic policy over the past decade has been that, in a sense, they've tried to do two things. Number one, they've tried to keep that old process of structural change going as full board as they possibly can. So they've been investing a huge amount here. Now let's look at, we'll skip that for now. Here we go. This one. So their investment rate has been extraordinarily high. Over 40% since 2004. So, in other words, they're building the cities and the roads and everything that enable people to leave rural areas, come to the city, and let this structural transformation process rip as rapidly as possible. At the same time, they've dramatically increased their investment in education, especially higher level college education. And they've adopted a whole set of policies designed to change China into an innovative society, policies that have a lot of support. But, you know, this whole bundle of policies are sort of all there on the table at the same time, and it's not clear exactly what the trade-offs are. So there are some difficult choices that they confront, which I think we can't quite get into right now. So, do I have another, say, 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
So let's take these themes then and bring them right to the present, right? Because we've had a huge shock, right, to the system, not just the global system, but also the Chinese system. In a sense, we've just had a heart attack, right? And I've ended up shuffling the order of this presentation, so excuse me for sort of jumping forward and jumping back. So what happened, you know, at the end of 2008? Well, you know, massive shock to everybody, but also to China, right? The Chinese economy was slowing even before the Lehman bankruptcy, so there was a very intense economic crisis in China at the end of 2008. But what happened? they confronted it with an extremely vigorous stimulus package. So in the U.S., huge stimulus, and in China as well, a huge stimulus. So China, at the end of 2008, used this authoritarian political structure to put through the world's, what I like to call the world's most Keynesian policy. I say it's the world's most Keynesian policy because it carried out, it created actual expansion and demand much more rapidly than our systems are capable of producing. You know, one of the big criticisms of Keynesian policies in the U.S. is there are big time lags. So you adopt an expansionary budget proposal, and it takes 2 years to work through the system. And so by the time the new spending is actually hitting the ground, you know, economic conditions have already changed. In fact, we're seeing that right now, right? More of the fiscal stimulus from the Obama plan is going to be hitting the economy in 2010 than ever hit in 2009. China's not true. In China, the shovel-ready projects were there. And by January, February of 2009, we were already seeing dramatic expansion in investment, dramatic expansion in domestic demand. So you just look at the blue line there. That's bank lending, which went to accommodate this stimulus program. And the Chinese bank lending just soared. And the result was it worked. You know, it worked in pure Keynesian sense, that it created domestic demand, pulled China out of the recession, and also helped to contribute to a kind of honeymoon period, temporary honeymoon period, between China and the United States, because we were both doing the same thing. We were working together. Our policies were highly consistent. Both governments were creating demand, and that was a lot more important than anything else. So the very sort of decisiveness and concentrated power of the Chinese system worked well for them in the face of this capitalist crisis. Very ironic in many respects. But the truth is, it did work, and it did help. Now, this will be my last slide, and let me just talk about how it... So I'll just bring this into the context of some of these other long-run trends we're talking about. So this is China's trade surplus, but it's kind of a funny measure. What it is a month-by-month number where the month is the sum of China's trade surplus over the previous 12 months. Okay. So what you see is from 2006 to the end of, to about mid-2008, right, you see China developing this huge overall trade surplus. And then China lets its currency appreciate a little bit, and the surplus levels off a little bit. And then a funny thing happens. When the global financial crisis hits, China's surplus increases. Now, that's very counterintuitive, right? Because you think of the global financial crisis as being an external shock that should hit exports. But it actually didn't work that way in China for two reasons. Number one, as we see, China responded with domestic stimulus quickly. So that, forget I said that. That comes later. China was already slowing, that's what I really want to say, in late 2008. And so its demand for imports was going down. But more important, China is so deeply enmeshed in this network of production that spans East Asia. Right? And this network has a particular configuration, which is that China is the point of final assembly for many, many things, including, say, your laptop computer, which almost certainly is assembled in China, out of components that come from other parts of East Asia, and also with CPUs from the United States. These networks are now so efficient that when the crisis hit, they froze. So imports into China dropped as corporations said, our final demand projections are going down, so let's not import into China the components that we need for the final products. So Chinese imports dropped really fast in the early part of 2009. China's surplus increased and reached a staggering $300 billion. Okay, so that's a lot. That's a level of imbalance which is even greater than the imbalances before the financial crisis. And that, combined with the fact that China froze its exchange rate against the dollar, led a lot of people to conclude that China was not making an adequate contribution to the rebalancing of the global economy. But look at this. Look at this fall from here to here. So these are January 2010 data, but remember, not just based on 1 month. This is the year of trade data up to and including January 2010. And what we see is China's surplus, overall trade surplus, is dropping fast. And it's already less than half what it was in March 2009. That's kind of staggering, particularly when you consider that most people think that the pressure on China to let its currency appreciate is increasing. People are becoming more and more fed up, as they say, with China and its currency policy. The reality is, this is what you'd expect for a country that's undertaking a really, really big, and in some ways maybe even reckless, stimulus program domestically. Huge increase in domestic credit, succeeding in rekindling domestic demand growth. Naturally, that pulls in much more imports, and China is growing and recovering faster than the rest of the world, so that increase in imports is significantly greater than the increase in exports. Now, what does all this mean? Let me just make 2 points, and then we can wrap up and open up to discussion. First, I think it means that it makes me optimistic that some of the current points of friction, I think, are going to turn out to be short-term, and that this is going to be that people will start to notice that China's trade surplus is shrinking dramatically, and that therefore China is making a contribution to global rebalancing. Second, this outcome is strongly reinforcing China's ties to the other East Asian economies. When you look at when you look at Japan, Korea, and Taiwan, their recoveries in the last 3 to 6 months have been driven by exports. And the largest source of those, the largest destination for those exports has been China. So the economic forces pulling East Asia together have been very, very strongly reinforced over the last year in two ways. One, China's decisive policy, which kind of led the recovery, but even more important, now the dramatic increase in China's import demand, which is definitely sparking an East Asia-wide economic recovery. So that means there's a more optimistic view, which isn't necessarily good for the United States in sort of long-run strategic conflict terms, but there's a more optimistic view that China could be better situated among its East Asian neighbors than was the case even, say, a year or two ago. And we may see Japanese policy continuing to reflect closer economic ties to China. But we don't have a crystal ball. And we have to acknowledge that there are these very powerful intersecting forces, economic forces, that make the sustainability of this miraculous Chinese growth at least questionable, right? I mean, not only are the long-run structural features changing, but this recent performance is so driven by an expansion of money and credit by a, you know, very, very strong stimulus injection. So you really have to wonder what happens when that fades, what's the withdrawal strategy, what are the unanticipated consequences as all this changes. So as we look at China going forward, I think we have to be more concerned about its economic performance and expect a slowdown from the growth rates that have been so apparent over the last 30 years. Now, how that's going to affect the U.S. and China and whether they're going to change places, I think I'm going to end on just a very agnostic note, and we have many people here who can.
Thank you very much. Okay.